Okay, most people are in or finding a seat somewhere. And for this evening's talk, somebody again sent an email to me, and being reinforced by another topic somebody asked me to talk about. And there was some advice, Buddhist advice, on how to deal with abusive relationships, and also why it is we get attached to pain and suffering, why we can't let it go. And of course, this is an important part of our modern world, even in a place like Australia, where you would think with all the law, legislation, rules about domestic abuse, about abuse of any relationship where one person is in power over the other, like a teacher and a student, a doctor and their patient, and boss and harassing their workers. There's so much understanding about the consequences of this in a modern country like Australia. But still it goes on. And, it is a problem. And this is what Buddhism is about, helping solve those problems, addressing them head on and finding some solutions. And of course, the first thing is just, why do these things happen in the first place? With the exception of children being an abusive with abusive parents, the children don't really have much choice. And the fact that they're there born and with these parents, and there they are. But in many of the relationships we have in life, we do have some choices. Choice, especially that one of the most important ways of avoiding abuse, of dealing with abuse, is avoiding it in the first place. Why is it that people go into these relationships, boy and girl, or boy, boy, girl, girl, or they go to these jobs and they put themselves sort of in harm's way? I always ask people, before you commit into any sort of relationship, at least you should test it out first of all. You don't just go and buy a car from a second-hand car dealer without taking it for a test drive and finding out, from the internet what its usual faults are and finding out about these things. So why do boys and girls, as they go out there, and they don't check out, who they're committing to, for goodness sake? You should. And if you can't check it out from your friends or find out who their exes were and get some of the dirt from them, the good qualities as well. Find out, for goodness sake, who you're actually going out with. There's also the fact that, when we do sort of have these relationships, it's incredible, just the idea of, like, love. The compassion, the kindness. In Buddhism, we always say that compassion, kindness should always be balanced with wisdom. It's the old Buddhist simile of the bird with two wings. If it's only got compassion, only one wing, the bird goes round and round in circles. It needs the wisdom as well. So when you fall in love, please don't leave your brain sort of, out of the equation. Otherwise, you get that old saying that love is blind. It shouldn't be blind. Because if really love is blind, then your relationships, or especially marriage, becomes an institution for the blind. And it can be much more than that. So, what little advice from a person like a monk. If you're going out with somebody and you think this is going to be a good relationship, test it out first of all. Come late for a dinner appointment or something and see how he or she reacts. Test them out first of all. Just get one of your, say if you're a guy, get one of your sister to leave an explicit message, on your SMS, or call her up while you're at dinner, and just to see how she reacts or something. Whatever it is, because these things happen in the real life once you're committed, and if you don't test it out, before you actually commit, you bought the car, and you've got an old bomb of a car, and you're stuck with it, and that's a really terrible thing. So, for goodness sake, girls and boys, just men and women, please use your common sense when you get involved in a relationship. Check it out, first of all. And as you sort of go out more and more, check them out. Test them. Just to see what happens. And that way you can find out their true nature. For those of you who are Buddhists, this has come from the story of Kaka, who was the maid of this, of her employer. And she decided to get up late one morning just to see what her employer would do, because she had the reputation of being a really kind girl. But when the maid started to misbehave, soon the true nature of her mysteries became evident to everybody. And now we have these hidden tendencies, and if we're going to be committed to one another, we've got to find out what those hidden tendencies are, first of all. And so avoid, first of all, if you possibly can. Just with the, it should be really easy before you get a job, you know, especially in an office or a sort of a company, to find out what's good companies, what are bad companies to go to. I'll do that research first of all, because relationships should not really be blind. Otherwise, sometimes you've got yourself to blame for these things. Keep your wisdom there as well. And of course, part of that wisdom is to know that, now, this is not normal, it's not acceptable, it's not usual to have abusive relationships, because some people think, oh, that's what marriage is like, or that's what relationships are like, that's not what we have to do, that's just, you know, what happens to everybody. But it isn't what happens to everybody. So at least, you know, be wise enough to know that a real relationship should be a kind relationship, should be a soft relationship, which is full of care, and people looking after you. Now, one of the problems also is with those relationships is, and I know this really well, because even I go to different monasteries around the world, nunneries as well, you can see those ones which are really successful, they don't have control freaks in charge. I think these two monks over here, I mean, sometimes if they criticize me, it's because I'm too soft. You know, certainly, you ask the monks, I'm not a control freak as an abbot of Bodhinyana Monastery. You know, I don't sort of control the monks. I encourage them, inspire them, and hopefully that they will do the right thing. And that's why it's a very popular monastery. You go to some other monasteries throughout this world, and there's only one or two monks who stay there. And the reason is because no one can live with them. They're just control freaks. And if you've got a relationship where one of you is a control freak, it's going to be very, very dysfunctional. And unfortunately, in today's world, I reckon the number of control freaks as a percentage of the population has increased. Number one is because we've struggled so hard. We've got so much literary stress on us that the only way we deal with that stress is just to get the control freak on us. Just, I'm going to get to work on time. And people just run the lights and they speed. Oh, I'm going to get my own way. And they use that force and that aggression. Unfortunately, that is praised in our modern world. The go-getters, you fought your way to get there. You know, I really struggle to get to where I am today. And they carry on thinking that with that sort of control and aggression, they can get the problems in their relationships fixed up. And the fear of letting go and trusting another person is a very difficult thing for a person to do. But quite frankly, in management, control creates bad management. Trust creates a beautiful management, successful office, successful Buddhist community. Now, this is one of the most successful Buddhist communities in the world, let alone Australia. Anyone who goes to other places in Australia, there's nothing like this place. Honestly, anywhere in Australia. Why? It is because, you know, understand to inspire, to trust one another, instead of always being so afraid that we control people. So in that relationship, please, you know, you have to have a lot of trust, which also means sort of allowing yourself to be afraid in a relationship, afraid of the consequences. Just there was one woman earlier, and I'm just going to encourage her again. She was thinking of starting a new business, really afraid, putting everything in, all the money into that business. She could go bankrupt. She could lose all that hard money she's earned for such a long time. No, please go for it. You have to have that faith, that courage to do those things in life, to take chances in life, and not to be so afraid. And even if it doesn't work out, it was worth it in the end. And this is, for me anyway, I sacrificed everything 40 years ago when I became a monk. And it was, you know, a bit sort of very scary sometimes being a monk. You didn't know whether you're going to be fed next time. You didn't have any security for your future. Still haven't got any superannuation, any other sort of nest egg for my retirement. I have to keep on working till I die. But I don't mind that. And of course, you're always willing to take chances and to be courageous. And sometimes you do make mistakes. But that courage to push things forward means you don't control anymore. You allow yourself to make mistakes. And you allow yourself to be criticized. You allow yourself not to always be the perfect person. And this is, here we go again. This is one simile I just use every other week these days. I've been using it a huge amount in Hong Kong and also in San Francisco. Simile of the tree. Now, you go in the forest. You go in the forest, find the most beautiful tree, and it'll be the crooked ones, the bent ones, the scarred ones. You go into a wood or forest, the most beautiful trees are the damaged ones. So you be a damaged tree. You be crooked. You be bent. You be wounded. And then you understand, this is human beings. This is perfection. So you don't have to live up to these impossible goals to be beautiful. You can just be you, all bent and crooked and scarred and damaged. You belong. Now when you understand that that is perfection, you don't control, you don't try and straighten up all the trees. You don't get some sandpaper and smooth off all the damage on their bark to paint all the brown leaves green. Because it should be green. You're not a control freak anymore, which means you can be at ease with things. You can let things be. Which is the most important thing in a relationship. Either at work, with your partner, with your children, or with your fellow monks and friends. But unfortunately, because that we are struggling so hard to meet expectations, that we get so frustrated, we think that the only way we can do this is struggle, strive, control. And that's one of the reasons why that we've become this control freak who, in a relationship, when there's any trouble, we think we're going to struggle and strive, we're going to make it happen. Which sometimes is very abusive. It's abusive either emotionally, verbally, or, the acts which we do, they may not get to the point of hitting each other, but sometimes they do get to that. It's abuse. So that's the cause of it, as far as I'm concerned. Just the fact that just as too many people are so afraid of failure, so afraid of what other people think of them, they want to control rather than just let things be. So number one, please, don't be ashamed if you make mistakes. Don't be upset if you're not perfect. Don't try and struggle so hard to be something you can never be. And then don't try and make your partner be something they can never be. Care for them rather than control them. And you find that that gives you better outcomes. I always tell people, this is the old story from the doctor. I don't know if he's here today, maybe listening. The doctor who was about to resign when he lost his first patient in tragic circumstances. And he thought he was a failure because the patient died. And I said to him, look, if you think your job in life is to cure people, you'll always fail. Not always, but many times in your life. The job of a doctor, a nurse, a psychologist, a friend, of a partner, is not to cure somebody, it's to care for them. So don't try and fix up their illness. Care for them. And then the illness gets fixed up. Care, not cure. Care for your partner. Don't try and cure them. And then the abuse vanishes. Because a lot of times people, they're in these abusive relationships. Sometimes they really, honestly, they think they're doing the right thing. She needs to be taught a lesson. I've got to cure her. He needs to be told. I'm going to cure him. And sometimes that wanting to cure people of what irritates you, what upsets you, what makes your life difficult or more difficult, because people have got so little resilience these days. You're on a knife edge. It's the one straw. It's all you need to turn you over the edge because you've got carrying so many burdens in your life. One more straw. If she says one more thing, that's it. And lack of resilience is one point, and also the point that we think that we need to control to solve problems. You don't. You need to care to solve problems. How many times do we try and solve problems in this world? By sending in the army, sending in the police, sending in violence, whatever it is, any sort of coercion, instead of caring. Caring is incredibly powerful. That's what heals things. Okay, this is a nice... Somebody actually rang up this evening. They wanted me to insert this into this talk. I didn't know how it would go into this talk on abuse and addiction to suffering. They heard me say that story, which is also in the Good, Bad, Who Knows book, of the thief who came to the Buddhist temple. I won't say the full story. Came to the Buddhist temple, robbed the temple, and the monk said, "No, you can take what's in the donation box. It's yours," and gave him some food left over as well. And the thief just ran away and was caught a few days later, put 20 years in jail, and then 20 years later came to rob the temple again. You know that story? It's very beautiful. I told it only about 2 or 3 weeks ago. And when he came to rob the temple again, the monk came up and said, "Okay, here's the keys to the donation box." And the thief said, no, I don't want the money anymore. He said, "I've been thinking about you for the last 20 years. The only person who's ever been kind to me in my whole life. I've just been so abused. But you actually, even though I pointed a knife at you, you said, 'Take the money.' And not only when you were being robbed, you know, that you looked at me and knew I was hungry and you gave me food as well. He said, 'I've been thinking of you for 20 years. I've come back to steal again from you. But last time I stole the wrong thing. I stole the money and the food. Now I want to steal your kindness. Please teach me how to care.'" And he became a monk. A very beautiful story. And apparently somebody was so impressed with that that they gave an ex-prisoner a job in their company or their work or whatever. And it works. They gave kindness to someone. Oh, actually, the prisoner or the thief actually stole from them. So they stole from this guy, and he gave them a job afterwards. Isn't that beautiful? That's caring. That cures. That changes the problems. Not all this violence and punishment business. So this is one of the other reasons why there's abusive relationships, because people still believe that punishment works. How many times have you been punished? Does it work? How many times have you got... Put your hand up if you've copped a speeding fine. Put your hands up. Okay. And will you stop speeding now? Of course not. All you do is just get to know where the speed cameras are. That's all you learn. Punishment never works. All punishment does. I learned this as a school kid. Now, when you got punished at school, all I learned was to make sure you were clever not to get caught next time. That's all. It just made you cleverer to avoid the teachers. That's all. But it never actually really understood why, you know, you did something wrong and how to overcome that. Punishment doesn't work. Caring works. And so that will take out the abuse when people think their partner or their worker in the office or their client needs to be punished, to taught a lesson. So this is actually where some of this abuse comes from. It comes from a culture of punishment, of struggling and striving to get your own way, you know, of not realizing that that is not what works in our modern world. It never worked in the old world either. The old thing about discipline... For those of you who've got kids and think, no, they need to be disciplined. I've got to make sure that they sort of pass their exams. I just came from Hong Kong. And the poor kids in Hong Kong, they just have to work so hard. Extra homework, tuition, holidays. They don't have holidays. Even if they've finished their homework at school, they get more homework from their parents when they get home. It's just so tough for them. And if they don't behave, disciplined. That is not the way to bring up kids. That's abuse. And I think some of you may know that, just how much pressure you had to succeed in life. And that's abuse. And we all know from Daniel Goleman's great book, Emotional Intelligence, passing exams is not the reason for success in life. I was Just a couple of nights ago, I was with this Buddhist from Oxford, Professor Richard Gombrich. We had a little discussion in public together in Hong Kong University. And he was really, really down on... He's a professor at Oxford, really down on examinations. And I told him one of the pieces of graffiti, which I saw at Cambridge when I was there. In those days, graffiti was really brilliant. And that particular piece of graffiti, four words, exams kill by degrees, it says. It's really beautiful because it's no success of your understanding of the subject, your passion for it, or your ability to use, you know, what you've learned, you know, for the betterment of the world, for your own career. All it teaches you is how to pass this blooming test, that's all. So, emotional intelligence is that learning to be at peace with yourself, happy with yourself, content with yourself, understanding your emotions and how they work so you don't get so angry, understanding your physical health, your body, emotional intelligence. Then, my goodness, you're successful, because when you understand yourself, you can understand other people as well. Then you can make relationships. I was telling some people, because there were Christians in Hong Kong, there is, I don't know if any of you have read those Gnostic Gospels, the Nag Hammadi Library, discovered in the town of Nag Hammadi, N-A-G-H-A-M-M-A-D-I. These are actually sayings of Jesus. Totally suppressed from Christianity. But these were sayings, ancient papyruses, valid, not fraudulent, which actually says some of the things which this guy actually taught. One of the things they said in there is, could be Buddhist, I don't care, Buddhist, Christian, I don't know, this is truth. Says, and they used the, please, the male gender thing, because this was 2,000 years ago, please forgive them. He who knows themselves knows the truth of all things. Brilliant saying. Okay, let's call it she who knows herself knows the truth of all things. Really powerful statement. Because if you know yourself, if you're mindful, get to know, understand yourself, you understand others. That's my trick. Spent years and years and years and years understanding myself, and now I can understand all of you guys. I understand relationships. I understand weird stuff like sex and shipping. These things which I've been before, which I'm not really supposed to know. At that time, say the shipping, I love this story. I was giving invited to a transport forum. That was Alana McTina when she was Minister of Transport a long time ago. She got to know me, invited me to this forum on transport in Perth. And when it's a Duxton Hotel in the middle of Perth many years ago. And when it came to lunchtime, they had it from like 1 o'clock till two. I couldn't eat that day. So I was hanging around, and so this reporter came up to me. And this reporter said, can I interview you? I said, yeah, what on? He said, shipping. And of course, like, you know, knowing me, I said, okay. Yeah, I'm fearless on those things. You know, you want to interview me on anything, I'll give it a try. And so, you know, having a bit of fun, wasting time for the hour because, you know, was couldn't eat. So anyway, they interviewed me, and I never thought twice about it until 3 months later I saw him. I think he came here. And he introduced himself. He said, I was that guy who interviewed you for that shipping thing. And he said, it was published and syndicated throughout all the major shipping magazines of the world. And he, you know, as the writer, got all these emails back from these professors and experts in shipping saying, we've never heard of this Ajahn Brahm before, but whoever he is, he certainly knows what he's talking about. Easy. That's absolutely true. So, and why did that work? It's just because you know the truth of yourselves. You know the truth of all things, including shipping. And relationships as well, men and women. So, but anyway, so this is the best way to avoid it. But look, you're in an abusive relationship. And why you get into those things, you know, that's, you know, you've been stupid. But a lot of times that people, number one, they are caught, they're trapped for many reasons. It can be economic reasons. They can't survive by themselves. unfortunately, these days it's easier to leave a relationship and survive. It can be you have kids and you stay together before because of the children. Or it can be just, you know, that sometimes you really love that other person. And you really think the best thing to do is to stay with them. That's for you and for them. Now, one of the problems with all of those sorts of arguments is that when you're right in the middle of an abusive relationship, you just haven't got perspective. The old simile, the hand is so close to me, I can't see it, anything other than my hand. I haven't got perspective. When my hand's right in front of my eyes, I can't see anyone in this room. I can't see the moon and the stars or the other monks or anything at all. All I can see is my hand. And that's what happens when you're in an abusive relationship. You're far too close to it. You just haven't got any perspective at all. If you can put your hand at the end of the arm, where it belongs, the hand is still there. It hasn't changed its size. You haven't ignored it. But once it's at the end of the arm, you can see everything else as well as the hand. You've got perspective. And one of the most important things, if anyone is in an abusive relationship, please get out for at least a little while. Get some perspective, for goodness sake. Because if you're in that house, in that office, in that institution, whatever it is, and if you're right in front of you, it's so hard to be able to deal with it and see what's really going on. Basically, you know, you may have the love for your partner or your kids, but you haven't got a brain. You've lost your wisdom. You haven't got the perspective to see what really needs to be done. So sometimes just having respite, time out, whatever it is. And a lot of times people have actually solved many of the problems from abusive relationships by doing that. Going on a retreat to a monastery or a church or some place where you can just take time out to be able to get perspective. And that's really so important in any problems you have in life. Sometimes just, we used to have these quiet places in life. It used to be, you know, when I was a young man, the churches, you know, in England. You could always go in there and just sit down. No one would bother you. And it was not just because you were a Christian. It was just because you had a quiet place. We could be left alone. Instead of, you know, having people trying to tell you, the therapist, please apologize for all the psychologists. But a lot of times the best therapy is just being by yourself and having time and space to see what the real problem is for yourself. And then actually once you've got that perspective, you know, you can find strategies, people to help you. But when it's right in front of you, you just can't do anything. And then you'll start to realize that, you know, the person who wrote to me about this, they said they still love the guy, but they're being abused. Look, if you really love the guy, please remember that, you know, that's just him in front of you. You put it out here and you can start to think about yourself as well. You count as well, which is one of the most important parts of loving Buddhism. It's not just about the others, it's also about me as well. The other thing with Western culture, and it's come about in Asian culture more as well, we become far too selfless. It's all about other people, sacrificing yourself for somebody else. And that means you get burnt out. You don't count. And I think I mentioned that great simile of the seven monks in the cave. Remember that one? It was only about 3 or 4 weeks ago, correct? About seven monks in the cave meditating on loving kindness. These bandits came and they wanted to kill all the monks. And the head monk managed to talk all the monks. So head monk managed to tell all the robbers, just kill one, and then the other ones can go free. It's a warning. And the head monk had to choose who would be killed. And I used to ask people the question about which one did he choose. And people always say he chose himself, which is the wrong answer. And of course, you know the answer. It's in Opening the Door of Your Heart. It's a powerful story. I'm only doing it in brief here because, you know, I told it recently. The answer was that the monk could not choose between himself and the others. Because his love towards himself was no more, no less than his love towards all others. And because I mentioned that, I think, because I gave this simile in San Francisco in front of a bishop who came to listen to my talk, and I called him out. You know, he put up his hand and said, yeah, sacrifice himself, because that's what he'd been conditioned to do in Christianity, self-sacrifice. When I told him the answer, his love towards himself was no more, no less than to all other beings. And I reminded him of his Bible, a Buddhist monk teaching the bishop about Christianity. I enjoyed that. You know, okay, I'm not perfect. Sometimes you like these little cheeky things. And I told him, it says, look, that's what it says in your Bible, to love your neighbour as yourself, which means to love yourself as your neighbour. And wow, yeah, that's really profound. Simple thing like that. Sometimes people don't see it. They can hear that so many times in their church. So love your neighbour as yourself. To love yourself as your neighbour is never thought about. But it's important. You count just as much as the other person. So that person who wrote that email, I won't say where they're from, who said they love that person, that's why they can't leave the abusive relationship, I would say, but you don't love yourself. You're sacrificing. And that's one of the reasons why people stay in these abusive relationships. Because they don't love themselves. They're sacrificing. You don't count. It's a really strange thing, but there's another part of this, which is people ask me, why are people actually attached to suffering? A lot of times in an abusive relationship, strange enough, you get used to it. There was this Thai girl married to a Chinese man. They used to come here many years ago. I know Rodney remembers them, Poonsup and George. And every time they came here, this Poonsup, the wife, she was so abusive to George. She would criticize him in public, shout at him, to all the other people who come to offer food on a Saturday, Sunday morning. She said, George, he's so stupid. He's an idiot. He's a terrible... George, come over here. And poor old George had to come over every time. How was this? I felt so sorry for him. But you know, when she died... And I thought that George would be free of this monster of a wife, always telling him what to do and just criticizing him in public, in front of everybody. That no, he told me, he misses her so much. He really missed her. And that was really weird. Look, you're free now. You don't have to have all this being criticized in public. But he got used to it. And that really starts to say why people get in these abusive relationships and they don't get out. This is a deeper meaning. Sometimes we are attached to suffering and we're afraid of freedom. It's a simile of the person in prison saying, next week your sentence is over. You can be free. But they've been in jail for 40 years. They're literally afraid of freedom. They're out of their comfort zone. Or even more important than that, and more funny than that, but the same sort of idea why we're attached to suffering. About the last story in my Opening the Door of Your Heart book, about the two monks who were best of friends. And they stayed together, they practiced together all their life. And when they died, one was reincarnated in this heavenly being, in this gorgeous heavenly realm. And the other one, because of some bad karma, was reincarnated as a worm in a pile of cow shit. It sometimes happens. Not all monks and nuns, you know, are really pure and good. But I didn't say why he did this. But anyway... Friendship is really important. I don't know for you, but if someone's my friend, I'll be there for you, if ever I can. If it's possible, I will try and help. And so, this heavenly being started thinking, I wonder where my friend is. I wonder where my partner was, because I can't find him anywhere in the heavenly realm. So he used his psychic powers, looked at all the heavenly realms, couldn't find his friend anywhere. And then he thought, maybe, he's been reborn as a human being. Because in Buddhism, the human rebirth is supposed to be a really good one. So you don't have to believe in karma and reincarnation for this story, because that's not the main meaning. The ending is the main meaning here, so please bear with me if you don't like reincarnation stories. But he looked through the human realm, couldn't find his friend anywhere. Surely not as an animal. Looked at all the tigers and the monkeys, the dogs and the cats, the higher animals, couldn't find him there anyway. Started looking at the lower animals, and there he found his friend. Oh my goodness. He's been born as a worm in a pile of cow poo. That's terrible. I can't let my friend stay like that. So the bonds of friendship were so strong, this heavenly being appeared in front of the pile of cow dung and called out to his friend, the worm. Because, you know, as a heavenly being, could actually speak like worm language. And in English it translated as, "Worm, do you remember me? In a past life, we were monks together, the best of friends. I've been reborn in heaven, you've been reborn in a pile of shit and dung and filth. Come with me." And so this little worm, he poked his head out and he said, "Well, it's amazing. Just, you know, I didn't remember that, you know, I was your friend in the previous life, but where do you want to take me?" He said, "Up to heaven. It's beautiful up there. It's wonderful and lovely and peaceful and pure." And the worm said, "Just one question before I go. Is there any cow shit up in heaven?" "Of course there's not any dung and poo and any filth in heaven. Of course there's not." "Well, I'm not going," said the worm. "Because I like cow shit. It's my food. And it's nice and warm and fragrant. It's my home." Because, you know, for a worm, you can understand, you know, worm psychology, this is just a blessing. This is like being in a big mansion. This is what many of you pay thousands of dollars to the bank every month for the mortgage of the ideal home. A huge pile of fresh cow filth is the ideal mansion for a worm. It's just in it's his heaven. So he says, "No, I don't want to go." So, of course, the heavenly being thought, if I could only show this worm what heaven was like, he'd understand. Because he doesn't know anything better than this pile of cow shit. So, the heavenly being, remember, this is a really refined being. You know, imagine like the Queen of England, but much more than that. would she put her hand, you know, in cow filth to pick something out? But this heavenly being, his bonds of friendship were so strong, holding his nose, he put his hand in a pile of poo to try and get the worm out. And he tried to get the worm out. Because the worm was covered with this stuff, it was all slimy and slippery, and the worm did not want to go. So he wriggled and screamed, and escaped and went right into the bottom of the pile of cow dung. And what did the heavenly being do? He put his hand right into the poo as far as it would go, searching for his friend. Every time he caught him, he pulled him out, but the worm wriggled away again. Pulled him out, wriggled away again. And in that storybook, 108 stories, I said, everyone reading this book is like that worm, and I've been trying to pull you out 108 times. Many of you have been coming here for 30 years, and I've been trying to pull you out as well. And I get you so far, but then after a while you wriggle back again. It's a gross story, but very true. Why is it that people are attached to their pile of cow shit? You are. Because you're used to it. Because you got accustomed to it and you know nothing better. Now that's abusive relationships sometimes. Sometimes when you're inside of it, in the middle of it, you don't know anything else. Afterwards, you know, when you get escaped, why on earth did I stay there? Why didn't I get out? But look, when you're right in the middle of it, it's all you know. is your home. And people stay. It's ridiculous. But that simile shows what attachment to suffering is. If that's all you know, if you're the prisoner who's got used to being in jail, even if it's tough, it's what you know. And anything else is scary. So sometimes people stay in abusive relationships because of fear. Fear of anything else. So for goodness sake, take time out. See different things. You don't have to leave your pile of shit permanently. Just come on a retreat for a few days. See what the alternatives are. Get perspective. And then finally, you don't feel that you are trapped. People aren't trapped by the relationship as much as they're trapped through fear. Fear of what other people will do to them, fear of the future, fear of taking chances, fear of leaving. It's not comfort zone, it's a discomfort zone. But it's the only one you know. So you stay there. So this is one of the reasons why when you can understand these things, what's happening, and then actually it's pretty easy, not pretty easy, but it's much easier, sorry. It's really, really difficult. It's easier to leave. You have the confidence. You have the guts to actually to try something else, to leave the jail. Yeah, it may be difficult at first, but something inside you tells you it's worth it. You follow that rather than your fear. And you count as well. And so once we can start to leave those abusive relationships, please don't go back again. So how many people do that? No, you've been hurt once. Don't be hurt again. Use your wisdom. Which brings me on to one of my other favorite Buddhist stories. And this is the simile of the five horses. And I teach this on retreats, but this was taught by the Buddha. And please understand this teaching. Once there was five horses. And the first horse, the rider would get on its back and just tell it where to go. And the horse would comply. The second horse, the rider would have to get out the whip. But this shadow fell on the horse. And the horse said, I better follow the orders. Otherwise, you know, I get in trouble. So that's the second horse. He has to only follows orders. He's only wise when a shadow of suffering falls on him. The third horse, the owner or the rider, has to just tap it slightly. Not hurt it, but just tap it, you know, with the whip. And then the horse knows what to do. The fourth horse is so stupid that the owner has to whack it. Ow! But only once. And then the horse realizes it's a mistake and will never do that again. And the last horse, the fifth horse, whack, 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 ow, 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 and still does the same thing again. So, which horse are you? It's amazing how many people identify with the fifth horse. Every time you get into trouble, you still don't learn. Every time you really get hurt, you go back and get hurt again. Come on, be wise. Learn. When you leave the abusive relationship, make sure you grow from it. You learn from it. You understand much more, because that is the meaning of life. To learn from the pain of life. To dig in the shit, its fertilizer, to grow from it, become a wiser, compassionate, more sensible person as a result of the pain and difficulties you have in life. So if you are in any abusive relationship, any pain or difficulty, if you don't learn from it quickly, you get hit again. So anyone who has been in an abusive relationship, and this is not just, you know, husbands and wives. It can be kids and their parents. I mentioned this years ago, but my father was in an abusive relationship with his father, with my paternal grandfather. Not sexual, but physical. And because for years and years and years, I used to ask my father about my paternal grandfather, you know, from Liverpool. And I never knew him, because he died before I was born. But, you know, you're... A kid wants to know his family. And so every time I asked my father, you know, what did your dad do? He would never answer me. And so when I don't know what age I was, but I pressed him enough, he just told me. And, you know, please excuse the words, because I have to say exactly what my father said. He said, your grandfather was a bastard. And that shocked me, that my father would say that word about his father. That really just threw me, and that's why I say it, because that was really hit me hard. I said, why? And he said, because, you know, he was in Liverpool in the Depression years, and he was a plumber. When he got any money, he would spend it drinking, and he would come home drunk, and he'd get off his belt, his leather belt, and he'd whip any of the kids he saw for no reason at all. Sometimes my father was on the end of that belting. He did nothing wrong. He said, that really hurt, but what hurt him most of all was when then his father started whipping his wife, my dad's mum. He said he couldn't stand that. But one of the things he said to me, and you know, it was true, he did it. He said, when I was on the end of that belting for my dad, he said to me, he said, I resolved, I made a decision, a conscious decision, a vow, a promise. If I survive, if I have kids myself, I will never hit my kids. He will never hit me. And he never did. He tried a couple of times. We deserved it, but he tried. He just couldn't do it. Because of the abuse which he had felt. He learned and grew from that abuse. Strange as it might seem. I know that some psychologists say that if you've been abused, then, you know, you put that abuse on others. If you've been abused as a kid, then you'll abuse your children or people in your care. It's not always the case. You have an option. You can learn, understand, grow. You can dig the shit in and transform it. And my father was incredibly wise and kind. And you know, maybe you may all say that, but you know, I'm a product of that. And I owe my father much. He is the one who did the opening the door of your heart, similarly to me. And some others as well. This is what can happen from abuse. But you don't go back there. Once out, you're free. You learn from it. And once you learn such things as to love and care for yourself, you matter as much as anybody else. You understand just to be careful next time. Don't be that worm, always going back to the pile of dung. Even though that it's maybe what you're used to, no. And if you are in those situations, please leave. If for anything, just for a week or 2 weeks, just to get some perspective, to get the hand out from in front of your eyes so you can see the bigger picture. And then you'll probably learn maybe to leave altogether. And that can be the best way to love. The last little saying, if you still care for that person who's abused you, and it can be done, it happens, as sometimes you know, we still love that person. Love at a distance. As the simile goes, love the tiger, but at a distance. Too close, you get bitten. And I must admit that, finish off, when I was young, you know, I was in the jungles in Thailand and Guatemala. I came face to face with a tiger once. Honest. People ask me these jungle stories. And the tiger was only about, maybe about 4 foot in front of me. Huge being. Huge tiger. And people ask me, you know, was I scared? And to be frankly honest, I was not scared at all. Face to face with a tiger and not scared. You know why? It's because that tiger was in the zoo and had all his big... That's the only time I've seen a tiger. So... Okay, so thank you for listening to abuse, and I've abused you with my bad jokes and that last story, so please forgive me. Okay, so thank you all for listening on the abuse and why we're attached to suffering. So are there any questions from overseas? Is the internet not working? Oh, yes, yeah. I know this. I go overseas and people say these questions are really good. If we can only have a few more questions answered, but there's not that much time. Anyone here with a question as well, please? Anyone for a question here, first of all? I can't see anyone. Okay, we'll do the questions here, first of all. Okay, from Thailand. Dear Ajahn, what advice would you give to a person whose partner used to be in an emotionally abusive relationship? She has a control freak wife who refused to put herself in anyone's shoes. She is controlling and unsympathetic. Whose partner used to be in an emotionally abusive relationship. Things like mindfulness training, just to get to understand how you're feeling and what's going on inside of you. You get to know your emotions, and one of the things you learn straight away when you get to be aware of how your emotional world works is that, number one, controlling it hurts you. It's not a nice thing to do to others. And number two, it also just doesn't work. It doesn't. Your goals of controlling is to solve problems and you make more problems. So if has a control freak wife who refused to put herself in anyone's shoes, send her off to the monastery to do a retreat, get some ideas about meditation. That will probably cure them. This is from Indonesia. How do we deal with our own controlling nature in a relationship? Understand it all comes from fear. And, you know, you have to overcome the fear and allow things to go wrong sometimes. Allow things, you know, not always to be, you know, so perfect. Now allow the trees and the forest to be bent. Now allow the dinner to be burnt. And allow things not to always go right. And then we're not afraid, we don't control so much. What if our fear results in anxiety? That's why we try so hard to control and prevent any bad thing to happen. Yes, anxiety, fear. Anxiety really can be overcome through meditation practice. So we have these great practices in Buddhism. Overcome the fear, overcome the anxieties. Look, you know, I go on TV and teach. I go in front of hundreds of people. I don't prepare what I'm going to teach. I don't prepare my talks. And sometimes you're on radio and somebody's asking you questions which you never know what to answer because you've never prepared or not. But I'm never afraid. The reason is because you understand that fear doesn't make you a better teacher or a better speaker. It makes you much worse. Fear, I'm afraid of fear, if you know what I mean. So fear is my problem. It's a problem. So I never let it come up. And one of the great ways of overcoming fear is a sense of fun and games. Play overcomes fear. So in relationship, do a lot of playing, fun and games. Allow things to go wrong. And then, you know, you don't try and prevent bad things from happening. And actually, when you don't try and prevent bad things from happening, less bad things happening. A story about when I was a young boy, got my first bicycle. And I remember that time. I was always falling off the bicycle because I was holding with my knuckles went white through fear, you know, falling off the bicycle. And I was so stiff from fear, I kept falling off. Now, because I was so afraid of falling off. And then, I don't know how I did this, but later on I just relaxed. And when you relax, you didn't really think about falling off. You relax so, you know, the body could accommodate, you know, to the bike moving this way and that way and going round curves. I never fell off then. I realized it's the fear which made me fall off. So, if you're worrying about things going wrong, then they will go wrong. If you have the confidence and play and allow things to go wrong, then they don't. As one of, you know, the monks know, one of the rules in the monastery is you're allowed to make mistakes. And I do that because I don't want many mistakes to happen. When you're allowed to make mistakes, they don't tend to occur. But when you really make sure that no mistakes happen, then they occur. Okay. From the United States, you have mentioned controlling does not work. How should someone apply this in the Buddhist path when he finds the precepts restricting and he broke one or more of the five precepts? Oh, you've broken the precepts, you evil person. You're going to burn in hell. Oh. I mean, that's nothing to do with Buddhism. You break a precept, you acknowledge it. And you learn, you forgive it, and you learn from it. Did it hurt breaking that precept? So this is what we do. We don't have controlling. In fact, breaking the precepts or making mistakes is our learning. This is actually how we grow from our mistakes. 70% rule, remember that one? It's in Good, Bad, Who Knows. When I was a school teacher setting the first math exam I'd ever done, I asked the senior math teacher, how do you set examinations in school? And he said, not too hard, not too easy. There should be just the average score should be about 70%. If the average score is 98%, it's too easy. It's a waste of time. If the average score is 20, 30, 40%, it's too hard, and that means people won't be motivated. They think they can't do maths, it's too difficult, and they'll give it up. 70% is the perfect score. Simply because it's a good score, yes, 70%, you can do math. And the 30%, that's the important part for me, their teacher, to find out where they are weak. To find out what they haven't understood. So I can teach that in the next lessons. And I realize that's the same with life. 70% rule. If you always get 100%, you have a nice life, but you don't learn anything. You don't grow. Pretty waste of time. 30 or 40% in life, you get depressed and suicidal. 70% is the best. Because, you know, you're doing well. You know, you're having some success in life. And the 30% when you have difficulties, that is where you grow and learn. That is the beautiful part of life, the growing part. So this is why, you know, broke the five precepts. Very good. 70%. What's 70% of five? That's 3.5. So as long as you keep 3.5 precepts, according to Ajahn Mun, oops, what have I said? But learn from your mistakes, for goodness sake. So don't punish yourself. Acknowledge, forgive, and learn from them. And then you grow and get really, really wise. So you know, you're not controlling. You know, it's actually you're learning. So after a while, and I've been keeping all these rules as a monk for years. And it's natural now. It's just what you do. And I can't see any reason why you should break any precepts. It doesn't make any sense to me. So, of course, it's just natural. I'm not a control freak, but I'm a really good monk. Keep my precepts. But, you know, it's no force at all. It's natural. Just like you're all good people. You're all good people. You don't try and be good people. It's just who you are. It's not controlling. It's just your nature. So, no control at all. Okay, any questions from here? Okay, so it's 9 o'clock, so you've got an extra 1 minute. We're supposed to finish at 9, so we won't be charging you any extra for the extra 1 minute. So thank you again for all those questions. I hope you enjoyed it. Now let's pay respects to the Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha, then we can leave.
Arahaṃ sammā sambuddho bhagavā buddhaṃ bhagavantaṃ abhivādhayami suvākkhato bhagavata dhammo dhammaṃ namassāmi Supatipanno Bhagavato Savaka Sangho Sanghaṃ Namāmi.